The filmmaker Gabriel Mann says a wildfire can be beautiful. He's not romanticizing it. His new documentary shows the intensity and devastation of these wildland conflagrations. But one of the angles he pursues in the film is seeing fire not as a destructive force, but as a regenerative one. He says, when you watch a wildfire up close, which he did for 6 years while following hotshot crews with the U.S. Forest Service in California, when you watch a fire up close, it's like watching a full life cycle. And he told us, when you encounter a fire firsthand, the experience can bite you. It can hook you. And that's what happened in 2016 when he saw the Sand Fire, a wildfire that took hold in the Angeles National Forest. He called the moment an inflection point.
We have breaking news in Canyon Country now, where a fire is burning out of control. In just over an hour, 1,500 acres have burned.
It ignited about 100 meters from my house in Santa Clarita, and it ended up becoming a ripper of a fire.
Take a look at these huge plumes of smoke behind me.
And it just ripped up the landscape towards Acton.
And it is at 0% containment. It is windy out here.
And I remember looking at it from my backyard, where I essentially had a front row seat. And you see this incredible firefight, jets flying overhead, helicopters zooming over your head, you know, the bulldozers and all this machinery, not to mention just the apocalyptic view of the wildfire itself. It looks like you're living in a Hieronymus Bosch painting. And I just ran up the hill with my camera and I started filming it. And there's something about witnessing wildfire firsthand that taps into something primal. We all have it. You know, combustion is the fount of all life in our galaxy. Anytime there's fire in front of us, whether it's a campfire or a bonfire, we're drawn to it. But wildfire is so uniquely powerful. It is the most powerful force in the universe. And to watch it transform the landscape and look like Godzilla in the process, it really does something to you. You just want more. You want to see more. And at first, you do sort of feel a bit of guilt. You're like, why am I enjoying watching this destruction? But as you get to know it and understand it better, you understand what this process of nature is, you realize it's not destruction, it's creation. It's this transformative, vital part of our ecosystem, and that's part of why it is so awesome, because it is creation. And I try to mirror that observation in my film, where, yeah, you maybe initially see it as this menace. And I think a lot of filmmakers who make films about wildfire, they're drawn to the destructive nature and they're drawn to the stories of the victims of wildfire. And it's always sort of portrayed as a menace and as an enemy. But you'll notice that the first line in the film is, wildfire is the greatest force of fairness in the universe. Because after spending all this time chasing these fires, that's what I began to observe. This isn't just this destructive force that just moves in and, you know, wrecks everything and wrecks lives. It is almost like a purification. It renews everything. A few months after the fire, it's almost like the landscape's reborn in this really beautiful way. If you spend enough time around it, you do start to see the beauty in it. And all of those elements, whether it's just the visual tapestry or the awesome power of nature and the revitalization afterwards, all of those elements contribute to the addiction that sort of makes you want to chase it and see more of it.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Gabriel Mann's film is called Hotshot, and it's the latest in our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it tonight at the City Library. Mann is joining us on the show today to talk about it. And we started with that kind of weird obsession people have with these fires and how he turned his own obsession into a film.
At the time, when I first experienced sand fire and I got to experience wildfire firsthand and I caught the fire bug, I was in a relationship with a lady firefighter. And the thing is, hotshots, they don't like to talk about their work. It's a pretty abusive work relationship in a lot of ways, but also it's a part of hotshot culture. It's like Fight Club. You don't talk about it. You certainly don't talk about it to the press. And So I admittedly, even being with this lady for a year or so, I knew nothing about her job until it landed on my doorstep. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, this is what you do for a living. Like you go in and you put it out by hand. So it was so awe-inspiring on a variety of levels. And I just grabbed my camera and filmed it and was so blown away by the visuals and inspired by the Herculean effort of the men and women who actually go in there and fight it by hand. I didn't know that I had a purpose or a direction so much as I just need to film this. I need to capture this. I need to get the vehicles driving through the flames. I need to get them camping out in the middle of nowhere and getting rained on and getting hailed on. I need to get them hotlining. I need to get them setting fire to this huge mountain. And so I just went to every single fire that I could. So from June until November and sometimes even December, I lived with my boots on, my pants on. My cameras were just sitting in the front seat of my car, and I would just turn on the radio every day. And the moment I heard that tone go out, I'd jump in my car and I would go. So I was just collecting all of the little bits and pieces of this universe. And then it wasn't until I stopped filming in 2020 that I really started trying to figure out, okay, I've got 32 terabytes of footage. How do I turn this into a story?
Well, it's interesting you say in the film, in so many words, it's difficult to convey this experience. So, and this is how you do put it, I'll just show you. So that's basically what the film is. And I guess in some ways, it didn't have to be a quote-unquote documentary. And I'm not even sure if you describe it that way. And maybe this is a good chance for you to talk a little bit about your other kind of artistic references, because it wasn't Errol Morris or some documentarian that you were kind of referring to, although maybe you did at times, but it was Terrence Malick. It was the Thin Red Line that you had in mind. So talk about that as it starts to develop about, like, what is this thing I want to make?
My credo going through the whole thing was show, don't tell. And so that's why I didn't include any interviews in the film or why it doesn't play like a traditional doc. And there's two reasons for that. Number one, I wanted to be authentic to hotshot culture. And that's the thing about hotshots. It's like Fight Club. You don't talk about it. They don't want to talk to them. And so it felt sort of antithetical to that culture to put them on camera and talk about themselves. Now, I filmed a bunch of interviews. I just didn't include any of them. I filmed them just for my own research. And a lot of the tidbits in the narrative and the narration, they're actually some of their direct quotes. And these were from a few of the fellas who were like, yeah, I'll sit and I'll do an interview, but I don't want it published anywhere. And so I would sort of take that and then internalize it. But the other reason why I did it was I didn't want to describe a 1,000-foot fire tornado. I wanted to show it. There's nothing like that. And so that was my credo throughout the whole film. Now, in terms of the stylistic influence, The Thin Red Line, when it came out, was probably the most impactful film for me, just from a stylistic point of view. The music, the voiceovers, the sort of poetic nature of the flow of the edit. And it was not a traditional film. The working title for my film before I changed it to Hotshot was actually Cold Black Line. And that's a reference to, that's the goal for every hotshot. They want to have cold black line because that's what stops the fire. And so to me, it was an homage to Malick and The Thin Red Line. And a lot of my cinematography was aimed at trying to get that, for lack of a better word, that beautiful, again, lack of a better word, cinematic approach to capturing this beautiful aspect of nature, not the run and gun documentary, we'll get whatever we get, we'll shoot it on an iPhone if we have to. I was just so stubbornly committed to trying to emulate that really graceful kind of cinematography that Malick is so well known for, because I felt like that's what does justice to this natural phenomenon that's so incredible and the epic struggle of what these guys are going through. And, frankly, at the good advice of my producers, they told me, just say that in the opening of your film, set it up for people. So that way they're not sitting here watching, what's this movie all about? Just say it. Like, I can't describe it. So I'll just show you. And so the whole point is I wanted to take you on a journey. I wanted you to feel what it's like to go through a complete fire season from A to Z. And I hope that we did that. And that's why I was so committed to getting right next to these guys, because I wanted you as the viewer to go on that journey.
Say a little bit more about music, the music you use in the film, and the references you yourself sort of take up. It's such a counterpoint in some way to what we're seeing, music. But then it starts to make sense as we go along. And you say in the film, you say you like to listen to classical music in a fire. First of all, explain why and talk about the way you decided to use music.
When I was chasing fires, I would put my radio onto the classical music station. The classical music would always calm me down. It helped keep me focused because you always make bad decisions when you're panicked. And so I would always have that playing in the background. You see that in the film a couple times where you can hear while I'm driving through these flames. And it is sort of an eerie contrast. But like you say, you made a really great point. It seems like a contrast. But as you watch the film and you watch the narrative develop and you see this sort of shifting view of what wildfire is, those choices actually do make sense. It does make sense to have Mahler playing instead of some, you know, crazy, harrowing dude rock or whatever, trying to really amp things up. It was just perfect, at least for the texture that I wanted to have for this film. And I hope that it resonates with the audience, but the thing is, I have no idea. But that's sort of the evolution of my music choices. They're a lot more muted than one might expect from like a crazy wildfire film.
I wanted to get a sense of what you learned about, I'll put it this way, the nature of fire. One of the things you mentioned in the film is you say you can feel it when you've lost the fire.
When the smoke column begins to rotate like this, that's when you know you're in trouble.
When you lose the fire, what it feels like is the air around you is boiling. Everything's lifting. Almost like there's, you know, staticky balloon over your head, and you can just feel that convection around you. And until you feel it, it's hard to describe that. But everything just feels like it's boiling around you. And you can sense that momentum, and you can hear the shift in the tone of the firefighters over the radio, the way that they communicate, where they start bumping things back. They stop trying to save that house. They're like, all right, we're going to bump back here. This is going to, it's going to go do its thing. We're going to go into extended attack. Let's go ahead and order up some resources for tomorrow and for the next few days. That's when you realize, oh, they're not even thinking they're going to contain it today. It's not even a question. So there is some kind of an intangible thing. And really what it is, I've gotten better at reading the weather. It really is like developing a muscle that we lose track of and atrophies with our modern lifestyle. And so I'd say that's probably one of the big lessons. The other one is hubris. It's getting a perspective on hubris, my own and us culturally. It's very frustrating to watch homes burn every single year. It gets exponentially more frustrating when you learn from these firefighters that they're all preventable, that we could easily prevent it. And it's not with helicopters and retardants and, you know, fire trucks. It's by just clearing our brush and being diligent and responsible stewards of the environment and our own property. And what's maddening to me is watching us continue this war with all of our machinery and all of our resources trying to fight the fires, knowing that it actually only makes them worse and bigger, and knowing that it all could have been prevented if we were just better stewards of the environment. And so I wish we could just sort of take a step back, see what the process is, and get reconnected.
Well, part of what you do is you spend some time on what you describe as burn history, like what it was like before humans arrived, like what a wildfire, how it behaved, and then when we got here. But before we get to that, because a critical part of the film is how you break down what it means to understand just the basics. You say the only way to stop a fire is to separate it from its fuel source. And so... this hadn't occurred to me, but like on its most basic level, this is what a hotshot crew does, you say. It gets rid of plants So will you talk a little bit about that, about the basics here? Because the thing that you also mentioned is stop thinking of a plant as a plant. Think of it as carbon. Think of it as fuel.
When we see a forest, a hotshot sees an ocean of fuel that can kill him. This is the most dangerous place to be on a fire.
Hotshots are considered, you know, the most elite special uses crew in the wildfire world. They're highly specialized. They're highly skilled. And so it's sort of natural for us to assume that they're doing some kind of wizardry or some magic. But at the end of the day, fundamentally, all they're doing is they're just getting rid of plants. And a lot of hotshots, they'll joke that, you know, in their job title, they'll put their extreme gardeners. That's all that it is. It's a really simple process. The carbon cycle on this planet, it's real simple. And all of those plants, they're just hydrocarbons. They're fuel for the next burn. And part of the reason why the fire history was so important, and, you know, admittedly, I was very ignorant to it when I first started. I had no idea. And like I said, I grew up in fire country. I didn't know anything about wildfires. And then I ran into a guy on the Ferguson fire, which was burning through Yosemite. And he had some downtime. And so he's like, he was really sweet. He took me on a walk through his division. And he was telling me all about the history of the Indians who lived there and how they used to ritualistically burn off the Yosemite Valley every single year. So the whole valley, they would burn it off. And he told me about how the age-old adage in the Yosemite Valley was like, you used to be able to ride a horse at full gallop straight through this forest. And he walked me over to this section where they were working. And he's like, now look at it. He's like, you can't even see 10 feet into it. He's like, it is so overgrown because we stopped burning. And they won't let us burn anymore because, well, it's going to hurt tourism. Nobody wants to see the smoke. And we haven't been doing this work for 100 years. And so that sent me down the rabbit hole of trying to learn more and more about fire history. Like, okay, well, clearly the narrative that we've been taught, there's something off with it. And then when you find out that actually the worst fires in the history of the universe were in the late 1800s.
Right.
Now, obviously, most people, they've never heard of the Peshtigo fire. They've never heard of the Great Michigan Fire unless you happen to live up there. And we're talking about Wisconsin and Michigan. These aren't typically...
This was 1870. What the hell is going on in 1871, by the way?
You know, this is... Okay, so this is one of the most interesting parts of the film is we learn that there were two fires in 1871 that were bigger... Just those two fires in a couple of days worth of burning, they were bigger than California's worst fire year ever. Not only were they in the same year, they were on the same day. And nobody even knows about those two fires because on the same exact day, the Great Fire of Chicago burned and decimated the entire city. Now, obviously, there was a really dry summer. There was this huge cold front that pushed through. And, you know, the most extreme weather always comes in front of cold fronts. And so there were just insane winds that day. So it was fire weather like crazy. But there are some people who theorize that there were meteor strikes. Because how do you have multiple conflagrations? And it's not just wildland fires, but also you had an urban conflagration in Chicago. Mm. And so there were people who suspected that maybe there was, you know, some meteor strikes, and that's why you had these simultaneous ignitions across that region. But ultimately, what fueled the Peshtigo fire in particular was, look, there was a lot of logging activity. And, you know, look, logging is necessary. It's not necessarily bad, and a lot of forests benefit from a clear cut. However, when loggers leave a bunch of slash, meaning all the branches and the bark and you know, a lot of the debris that isn't useful for timber, it stacks up and it just dries out. And it's just, I mean, that's a powder keg waiting to happen. And so these forests were just full of slash piles. And so when the right conditions hit and there was an ignition, it was off to the races. And there were 120 mile per hour winds fanning these flames. So, I mean, these are nightmare conditions creating fire activity that you and I couldn't even fathom. And I've been to some of the worst fires in recent memory. The description of what happened on the Peshtigo fire, like train cars melting to the tracks, I've never seen anything remotely that bad. So I immediately ask myself this question, well, like, if those fires were so much worse back then, but I'm told that the climate was more favorable back then, clearly there's something else at play. There's another variable that's driving this fire activity. What I've discovered about wildfire is, look, this is preventable, at least in terms of our stuff burning. But the process. It's just been a part of our history for the entirety of human history. Mm. What most of us don't know is that our ancestors, the Native Americans, were very proactive in burning everything.
The natives in the Western Sierra ritualistically burned out the Yosemite Valley every year. And while they inherited a dense forest with a volatile fire landscape, with 10,000 years of Indian burning, they reduced the average fire debt from over 100 years in the pre-human era down to less than 5 years. There is never more than 5 years' worth of fuel in any inhabited area. And thus, they made the giant devastating fires of the past extinct.
I mean, talk about human influence of ecosystems. Probably the most dramatic human influence we've ever seen, way beyond any carbon or pollution, is what the natives did to transform the landscape, in particular North America, by putting fire on the ground every single year, burning tens of millions of acres every single year. And it really cleared out the forest, and they did it for a lot of reasons. Yeah, it protected them from wildfires, but also it cleared out a lot of that brush that commingles with the trees. It attracted grazing animals for hunting. It also gave them better line of sight for predators, you know, because you didn't have this dense forest that you can't see through. And anyone who's seen a burn scar and the regrowth that happens, and we show this in the film, at the end of the film, we show that regrowth. It's spectacular. Yeah. Yeah. Nuclear green. And all those wildflowers that pop up, they attract all these pollinators. You know, the bees come in, and you see this ecosystem just revitalized and coming to life. You don't have to be a rocket surgeon to understand what's happening. There is a proactive solution that we can take that doesn't involve trillions of dollars in helicopters and retardant and all this crazy effort.
Gabriel Mann, he directed the film Hot Shot, which we're going to be screening tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. You can find details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. You say in the film that there is an inevitability of a wildfire that we seem incapable of accepting. What do you mean by that exactly? And I guess maybe it's a few things. On one hand, it's we don't want to accept the devastation. We don't want our cabin burned down or house in our subdivision, you know, wherever, of course. We don't want our animals killed. But it seems like there's something else that we're incapable of accepting, and that's maybe what it would take to actually change things. Because I think we had a conversation like this with the Great Salt Lake, whereas it's diminishing. It's really in trouble right now. And I think the initial sense was that it was because of climate change. And there's no doubt climate change is going to exacerbate the problem. But it's not climate change that's diminishing Great Salt Lake. It's the fact that water is being diverted. In other words, it's our fault, and it's something that we can fix. And it seems like there's a connection there for the way you're thinking about it, that, yeah, climate change is a thing, but that's not the thing to blame it on, because we can figure this out. We can fix it. Is that right?
This is a very astute observation. And I'm a barefoot, hippie, liberal Californian my whole life, and I've always considered myself an environmentalist. But I got to be honest with everything, in particular with what I've learned with wildfire, I've come to see the climate change debate in a different light, because what you're talking about is environmental change. And we absolutely have tremendous influence over our immediate environment. The climate is going to go through radical shifts. It always has. And I just don't know that we should get too concerned with that aspect of what we're dealing with. However, you can look at something locally that's affecting your local environment. Like, they're getting more precipitation in Las Vegas, in the middle of the desert, just because there are more golf courses and more pools. And there's more precipitable moisture that's getting evaporated in a landscape that used to have none. So we absolutely have a major impact on environmental change. And that, to me, is the biggest concern. Now, when it comes to climate and wildfires, look, wildfire gets hijacked as a cudgel in the climate debate because, you know, a lot of ways it's sort of a metaphor. It's burning. And so if you're trying to tell everybody that we're burning up, then it's sort of the great poster child. My frustration is that there's a big opportunity cost getting everybody distracted thinking, well, if the problem is wildfires and all of our stuff burning, we need to focus on electric cars and solar panels, which will do nothing to stop wildfires. It'll do nothing. But if you just clear your brush, your stuff won't burn. Now, as far as the inevitability of wildfire, this is a permanent part of the ecosystem. There are a lot of species of trees that actually require fire to germinate the seeds, like the lodgepole pine, for example. That's the pine that dominates the forests out in California. It actually, the pine cone, it's this resinous cone that actually needs to burn so it'll explode and release its seeds. So it requires fire to regenerate. And every ecosystem has a life cycle. So last year, Canada was the big story. And it's going to be a big story again this year. It's going to go nuclear again. The thing to understand about that landscape, it's the North American boreal forest. Those forests are dependent upon stand replacing fires, meaning the entire stand of trees has to get wiped out every 150 to 200 years. So you watch these fires going off in Canada, and all these trees are about 150, 200 years old. And nobody asks the obvious question. They're weeping over the trees getting burned up, but nobody asks, like, hey, why are these trees only 150 years old? Like, yeah. Maybe there's a clue there. Why aren't they 200,000 years old? That's because every 150 years, a fire wipes them all out, and it regenerates. And this is a healthy, natural, and permanent part of the ecosystem. Overgrowth is so much worse for the forest than a wildfire. And wildfire is essentially nature's cleaning crew. So if people can see the full arc of the wildfire narrative, not just the burned out homes and the crying victims, but that regrowth and this whole process is going to continue to repeat itself. That was, to me, the big goal in the film was to show the full arc and leave people with two things. Number one, this is a purification process and it's all going to come back. And number two, it's going to happen again, and it's going to keep going and keep going. So the sooner we can just accept it, then we just go, okay, this is something that's going to happen every day like the sunrise. So we're just going to protect the things we don't want to burn, and everything else can just do its thing.
So fire suppression makes fires worse.
100%.
Why do we do it? And this is, I guess, the part of the film, maybe say something about how you work through the economics of this fire industrial complex, basically.
Well, I've told you there was a transition in my experience with wildfire where at first you're sort of awed by the firefight. And it really is awesome. The machinery is incredible to watch. These fire aviators are nuts. And the stuff that they do, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And the thing is, you can get seduced into loving it even more when you see someone flying a DC-10, you know, a few hundred feet just right over people's homes and dropping this pink mud over it, and they save the home. That's the thing. Retardant works. Yeah. All these things, they do work locally, right? But the problem is, when you suppress a fire, we should phrase it differently, frankly. You're not suppressing a fire, you're suppressing nature's cleaning crew, as we just described, right? So why do we do it? Well, like I said, you'll see a helicopter save a home. That's real. The problem is we get seduced into thinking, and this is, you know, that's that hubris again, that we can stop it on this large scale, and you just cannot. And I've been on a lot of fires where you hear air attack, you know, and their command of all the aircraft. They're dealing with a mile-wide fire front that's just having its way with the landscape. And I've heard them say this, like, dude, we could order up every tanker in North America. It's not going to make a dent. When the flames get over 11 feet high, that's when you sort of lose your ability to do anything.
Yeah.
And it's just really, when does it get to a point where it runs out of fuel to burn? Why do we do it? Well, there's a lot of money in it. I can't come to a conclusion other than, you know, people see fire racing towards their homes. They say, do something. So of course we're going to, but who's financially motivated to stop this process? You know, every time there's a huge wildfire, there's a bunch of cars that get burned up. Well, those cars have to be replaced. Yeah. A bunch of homes have to get replaced. A bunch of power poles that have to get replaced. There is a huge economy that's predicated on not just the firefight, but the destruction from the wildfires. So the problem that I see is we have a lot of perverse incentives. There's a lot of people making a lot of money, not just on the firefight, like the private contractors with all the aircraft, but also people making money off the destruction itself. And that includes the media.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because this is another part of that kind of fire ecosystem. It's what you describe as fire porn.
Media clowns flock to wildfires like moths to a flame. They plant themselves in front of a raging head fire for the cool shot, and then have to run for their lives when it outflanks them. They overhype the intensity of the incidents for their fire porn, staging shots to heighten the drama for their unsuspecting viewers.
Talk about this part of it, because it's more abstract than just somebody who's trying to sell a fleet of vehicles. It's more complicated than that.
It is very complex. There are a lot of variables at play and a lot of different incentives at play. I remember the Woolsey fire in Los Angeles. It was a very devastating fire. It was probably the worst in LA County history in 2018. And it burned through an area where I grew up. And so I went down to PCH and I was sitting there watching this restaurant that I used to go to as a kid slowly getting consumed because the resources were so spread out that there was nobody there to defend. And then a couple of news guys rolled up behind me because they saw the building burning, and they come out and they're squealing, "Burn, baby, burn." And they were laughing and cheering. And that moment, I not only was it disgusting to me, but it made me question what I was doing because I didn't want to be I didn't want to be a bro with a camera who's like a part of this, celebrating the destruction. But the more you are around the media folks who go to these fires, the more you see they really enjoy this and they're really exploiting it. And there'd be times when, you know, the fire's calming down, it's coming downhill, which is very low intensity. And I know, all right, I'm done. This thing's over. It's not going to do anything. They're going to catch it. And so I'm ready to go home, and I'm listening to, you know, the news guy to my left who's doing his remote, and he's talking about, like, fire's burning dangerously close to homes and 10,000 people are evacuated. It's going to be a tense night. And they're really amping up the intensity when anybody who knows anything about fire knows this thing's out. Why are they trying to scare people? Why aren't they being more genuine about it? I don't know what the motivations are, but they are complex. I think there's motivations to amp up the climate crisis. There's motivations to just show destruction because it gets eyeballs on the screen. There's a lot of ignorance about whether or not this is good or bad, or what fire behavior is doing and what we can do to stop it. But a lot of people are making a lot of money off of it. And so it leads to some pretty irresponsible reporting. And so because of that experience of watching so many of them celebrate it, it really turned me off. And I felt the need to expose how these people are operating in this space, because it's quite grotesque. And so I wanted to sort of peel the curtain back and give people a glimpse of, like, look, man, the way that they portray the feelings of firefighters and selectively quote them, it's not accurate. This isn't how they feel. Hotshots hate these people. They avoid them like the plague. And you're not getting the full story.
That's the filmmaker Gabriel Mann. He directed the documentary Hotshot, and we're going to be screening the film tonight at the City Library at 7 o'clock. You can get more details if you need them at radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. You say in the film that fire destroys everything it touches, including you. So why do they do it? Why do these hotshots do it? They risk their health. It must take years off their life. I can't imagine it wouldn't. Not to mention just the sheer danger of it on a fire itself, but the prolonged effects of something like that must be incredible. So do you think you understand why they do it?
This is a story of time immemorial. It's young men challenging themselves, facing danger, testing themselves, getting some adventure and some risk. And look, you know, I say young men, there's obviously some women who do it, but this burden is predominantly worn by men. And, you know, you can make a little bit of money. You get this radical exposure to nature. You learn all these skills that sort of equip you for a more confident life in the future because you can handle yourself in dire situations. It enforces discipline. And you get to witness this awesome, you know, again, it's a destructive force of nature, but it's a purifying force of nature. There's something really awe-inspiring about it. And even the most gristled meathead is not immune to being moved by that. These are some of the most thoughtful, esoteric, creative people that I've encountered. I work in the film industry where, you know, everybody prides themselves on being really pensive and esoteric and creative. A lot of these hotshots, while they're out there, you know, just putting a dip in their mouth in these back roads in the middle of nowhere, they're sitting and writing rap songs, or they're writing a book, or they're reading a book, they're reading poetry. It's an incredible place to meditate and to expand your brain and get connected with nature. And also, you get to go places that most people would never get to go. That, you know, I touched on this in the film on that fire, the Ferguson fire in Yosemite. I had the entire park to myself. I mean, that's something you never get to experience. Like, you have the credentials to get past the roadblocks. The entire Yosemite Valley was evacuated. And so where else on the planet would you have the opportunity to just walk up to these most incredible icons of the West and have it all to yourself?
Along that line, you mention what it's like at night. Not when they're fighting furiously, that's different, but when there's maybe a lull in the action, because you say it's kind of like sitting around a campfire, weirdly, which gave me a real sense of what it might be like on the ground with one of these hotshot crews. You say time can disappear.
It absolutely does. And it does so in a variety of ways. So when you have a really, really, really nasty fire, and you see this in the film, daylight will get completely blacked out. And day will turn to night when you're under that smoke column and you get really disoriented, sort of like a Vegas casino. You can lose track of time. And overnight, there is, you know, there's both an eerie quality to it. There's a disruption to the normal patterns of the wildlife as well. The insects stop making noise. The birds stop making noise. You know, I remember when I was in college and I was pulling all-nighters, working on these papers, you know, desperately trying to get it done at the last minute. Those birds at 4:30 in the morning, that was that first nightmarish sound that told me, oh, the new day is here. It's time to go. All that disappears. So you have no indicators of what time it is. Sometimes in the middle of the day, it's completely dark. And then at night, you just have this glow that goes on and on and on. And there is something hypnotic about just sitting around the fire. And the camaraderie is palpable. It, like, that is probably one of the bigger draws beyond just the adventure and the danger and, you know, testing yourself. It's just the camaraderie. You're not distracted by a cell phone. These guys, hotshots, are like a throwback to the old West. I mean, they still fight fire the same way that our forebears did. It's the same rudimentary tools. They don't need all the fancy stuff. You just, frankly, you need a lighter and you need a pickaxe and you can do that work. And so it is sort of like sitting around a campfire with your fellas, and there's just something universally awesome about that. Even today, you put a bonfire in your backyard, we all just sit around it, stare at it. So imagine you've got 50,000 acres of that all around you.
One of the terms that we learn in the film is fire debt. And all of that fuel that you leave on the ground, that's your fire debt. And you mention how some people are dealing with their debt. Florida, for example, they do burns to diminish that, but not in California in one place. And I wondered if there's a difference between the West, because I'm thinking about Utah. Florida surprised me, I have to say. But you say that California only pays 3% of its fire debt every year. So in order to restore, this is how you put it in the film, in order to restore a balanced ecosystem, California right now would have to burn 20 million acres. And that just seems like there's no way that's going to happen. But you also say the only way out of this is to burn our way out. So what do you think is going to change? That seems crazy.
just to set the groundwork here, you know, yeah, fire debt touches on the inevitability of wildfire and its necessity as part of our ecosystem. It has to happen. You have to get rid of those fuels that drop to the forest floor every year. You have to clear out that vegetation competition for resources. Otherwise, the forest chokes off and dies.
Yeah.
You have to do it, just like paying your taxes. So if you don't do it, you're accumulating a fire debt. And the worse it gets, the more volatile it gets. So you cannot just ignore it. And more carbon is coming out of that ground every single year. So you can't just let it go. It's going to get worse and worse. Now, Florida is tremendously proactive with putting prescribed fire on the ground. They'll burn 2 million acres every year. That's unfathomable in California, where, I mean, we've only diminished how much we were burning in California over the last several decades to the point where they're burning maybe 30,000 acres in a state that needs to burn the natural burn rate, meaning what nature needs to get rid of every single year in California, is 4 to 11 million acres every single year. That's how much needs to burn. That's how much would burn naturally. It's 4 to 11 million acres. Now, the worst wildfire season in California's history was 2020. It was 4 million acres. So that, the absolute catastrophe that everybody is terrified of, that just scratched the bottom layer of the threshold that we need to burn in order to have healthy forests. Now, why is Florida better at it? I don't know. Honestly, I mean, this is a question to ask our bureaucrats. Why is it that they take it more seriously? I think a lot of people are surprised. They don't realize how forested and flammable Florida is. And we think, oh, well, they get so much moisture. They get these hurricanes. The hurricanes actually make the wildfire danger way worse. So what happens when a hurricane moves through, knocks down a bunch of trees. Now those trees are dead and down, and they're disconnected from their water source. So now they're just dry kindling. They're totally dead. And that makes it way more volatile. So people need to understand that Florida doesn't have massive wildfires, not because it's you know, got a better position climate-wise. It's a really hot, sunny place with tremendous amount of growth and tall grass. It's very volatile. They're just so diligent about putting a lot of fire on the ground. When you talk to their PIOs, their public information officers, they'll tell you every day in Florida is a good day to put fire on the ground. So that is their forward-thinking, connected to their ancestors kind of attitude that they have. In California, it's, what if people have to breathe smoke? They get terrified of people breathing smoke. And in California, the California Air Resources Board, CARB, they actually have veto power over when you can burn. So they'll straight up tell a lot of burn bosses, nope, can't burn today because you're not going to get good smoke clearance and people are going to have to smell smoke. The point that I try to make, it's frankly a point that's been conveyed to me by a lot of hotshots, like, guys, you're going to get it anyway. And the thing is, if you get it in a wildfire, it's going to be so much worse because it's going to be homes and cars burning. When we put fire on the ground proactively as prescribed fire, it's just trees and stuff. And I'll tell you from personal experience, being out in the middle of a wildfire, it's not so bad. You can breathe it. You know, your eyes might water a little bit every once in a while, but it's not so bad. But when you are in an urban conflagration with chemicals burning and homes burning, it's nightmarish. You'll get a splitting headache after 5 minutes. You know, like, oh, this thing is killing me. This is devastating. So you're going to get the smoke anyway. Do you want it to be lighter? Or do you want it to be dense and heavy and giving you cancer? The answer to me is obvious, but California is not doing it. In fact, they've only conspired to get worse. In 2020, the governor of California made the pledge, oh, we're going to burn 1 million acres every year. They're not even remotely close. Last year, they burned 60,000 acres, and it was the most advantageous year they could possibly do it. They had a ton of rain. They didn't have any wildfire threats. It was a tiny fire season. They could have been lighting everything on fire and starting to pay off that debt. Instead, they're even further behind because with all these rains, they have so much more growth. Yeah, that 20 million acre figure, this is what a lot of foresters and fire scientists have said is like, out of the 35 million acres in California's forested areas, we got to burn about 20 million of that just to catch up with all of these years of not just fire suppression, but being derelict in our responsibilities of putting fire on the ground.
Let me ask you, Gabriel, finally, the film becomes toward the end kind of a reverie, like this moment of reflection where you ask, what if we just let it go? What if we let it all burn? And maybe I'm coming back to your sort of reference to Terrence Malick, and you're wanting to sort of return to imagery and words here. But will you talk a little bit about what you're getting at in this part, finally, of the film?
The storyline mirrors my journey in this 6-year span of going from dude rock, big fires, put them out,
yeah,
to seeing the frustration of running into the same thing year over year, and then surrender and capitulation to the power of nature. And so the film's tone really, it does shift, and it really comes in for that softer landing towards the end, because A, I want you to feel what it's like to go through that grind of fire season, how it starts off really enthusiastic and fun, and then it just grinds you down, down to the bone, until you finally just surrender. And the film similarly comes in for a landing in that way. And that question of what if we just let it all burn? It comes back to at the beginning of the film where I ask, if life feeds death and death creates life, well, then how do you separate the two? At what point do you decide, well, this fire is destructive? Is it when it's destroying that tree, or is it when that new tree is growing? Where is that line? And that is a question I don't necessarily have an answer for. And aside from just, you know, the physical blurring of time on a wildfire where you can't tell if it's daytime or nighttime, sometimes you're on day shift, sometimes you're on night shift, sometimes you're sleeping under July sunlight, all of it becomes this jumbled mess. And you do get to a point late in the fire season when you're a hotshot where you're just like, why are we even doing this? And I come to that point just sort of globally as a community out west of like, why are we doing this? Why, like, we keep fighting it and people are dying in the process. Why are we doing this? What if we just let it burn? What would happen? And we haven't tried that since our ancestors were here. We haven't tried it. And the thing is, at a certain point, maybe we should just let it go. Clear out the stuff around our homes and then just let it go. What would happen? Well, we don't know until we try, but you know, every historian will tell you the forests were in much better shape. And we touch on that in the film. The forests were in much better shape when we inherited them and we've run them into the ground. And so it's a question that I think it's worth asking. It's very challenging. So I understand that. I'm not ignorant to the reality that there's going to be a lot of pain if we do what needs to be done. If we do burn those 20 million acres and we put more fire on the ground, we've so deeply entrenched ourselves in the wildlands. There's going to be some damage, but is that worse than what we already have year after year? When we see all these communities getting devastated, wildfire is the biggest threat to the United States. It is the biggest threat, way more than ISIS or Al-Qaeda or anything. And yet we almost treat it like we're completely disempowered and there's nothing we can do about it. And we haven't prioritized it. And unfortunately, every year we seem to get a bad lesson. Last year it was in Hawaii. This year it'll be somewhere else. It's probably going to be, you know, around Michigan, near Canada. We have to change what we're doing. So what I hope people do when they watch the film is they ask the questions that I've asked myself, which is, why are we doing this? And what dominion do we have over nature, if any? And what is our proper role in this natural environment? For me, it was about stepping back and looking at it from a different angle. And it was a humbling experience. I don't have the answer to it. And so I hope that people who watch it, maybe they have an answer to those questions. And they'll reach out and inform me, because I'm still searching for the answers even 10 years later.
Gabriel Mann, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Gabriel Mann. He's the director of the documentary Hot Shot, which we're going to be screening at the City Library tonight at 7. You can get details at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.